Thanks, Flo, for that. You'll notice from the title of what you can see on the PowerPoint, it's not quite to do with climate, although climate is a big part of what we're going to be talking about this morning. Today's talk is really an exploration of the point at which we are now and some thoughts about... Sorry, I've just been told that I need to speak up a bit. So today's talk is really about where humanity and the rest of the planet is and some exploration of that and also some thoughts about where we're headed if we continue on the pathway that we're currently on. I probably need to give an idea about the structure of today. As you know, Tyson and I will be talking. I'm going to be talking for the first bit and then Tyson will come in about halfway through and give some discussions at that point. Part of my talk is pretty much about the current state of play. So it's, I was thinking before, normally on a day like today at this time of year, you get people coming in and talking about the glory of God's creation, how wondrous it is, how beautiful it is, and how much it inspires us. This is not going to be one of those talks, I'm afraid. Listening to the story that Fleur read and the readings, those things are still true. Nature does inspire us and God's creation is something that we can gain a lot from. But this is really a discussion about where we're at to and where nature is and where we are. It's the first of two sessions because, as you would understand, it's a big topic. And in fact, even today, we're not going to be able to get through anywhere near in depth the totality of the thinking around this stuff. But it is something that we're going to look at over two sessions. Today is the scene setting, if you like, and some thoughts about where we're going to. It's the start of a conversation. So that you know, both Tyson and I are very happy to have further discussions with people. There probably won't be a lot of time for questions because of all that we have to talk about, but we're certainly aware that there will be questions potentially, and we're very happy to have those conversations outside today. And the next session that we'll be doing in about a month's time in December will be more focused on that kind of to and from. So today, as I said, we're looking at some definitions and overview. And look at some of the potential impacts of what global overshoot is, some of the critiques about it, because it's, as you can guess, not an uncontroversial topic. And that's been done in the context of certainly my personal journey and Tyson's journey in coming to grips with some of this information and starting to look at some of the Christian or potential Christian responses to this. As I said, I felt like in some ways I should have introduced myself. Hi, my name's Luke, and I'll be your voice of doom for this morning. it's not necessarily a very uplifting talk, or at least not my bit of it anyway. And so I'm also aware that, you know, there may be people in the congregation today who this isn't what you want to hear, or you're not in the frame of mind, and that's okay. You know, if you feel like you'd rather go for a walk in the beautiful sunshine and enjoy God's creation, that's absolutely fine. We won't be, at any way, offended. The other thing I wanted to say is that I'm not a scientist, and I'm not even scientifically trained. This is a layperson's point of view, and you know, open to question, of course. The science that's being addressed or discussed is nothing that I've had anything to do with. It's the result of others' research and work. I'm also very aware that there's several people, probably many people, who have an interest and quite a deal more experience and expertise in this this area than I do sitting in this room. And it's I'm certainly very open to be being gently corrected where you feel I'm not, or I'm straying from fact. The controversy point is really, as I said before, it is a controversial topic or set of topics. A lot of that controversy comes from the idea that, you know, we are living in a finite world, but a lot of our principles, our socio-economic theories are really often based around infinite growth, and that's a mismatch that I think generates a lot of the heat and light around some of the controversies. So what is overshoot? Basically, it's that point at which the natural environment becomes unable to support existing numbers of an existing particular species without significant impacts, negative impacts. And often that's put in the terms of carrying capacity as well. And you'd all be familiar with these sorts of things. I mean, I don't know if your house is full of millipedes at the moment, but every so often we get waves of millipedes coming through, and then they die off. And that's an example, I suppose, of a species that might expand, the numbers expand rapidly because the preconditions are right, and then either because they don't have enough food or can't access water, or the predators that prey on them also increase, the numbers die off quite quickly. And that's an example of where that species goes into overshoot and a rapid die-off and then back to some sort of equilibrium. Other examples are mouse plagues that you get, and I don't know if your garden's like this, but cabbage moths seem to be going berserk. So in terms of then taking that idea a step further, global overshoot is really looking at the humanity's demands on the ecosystem, on the Earth's environment, and the point at which we as a species have gone into drawing on the global credit card, if you like, and basically drawing on the Earth's natural supply and capacity. Now, this isn't a new sort of thinking. Thomas Malthus is probably the most famous proponent of these kind of limits of growth and limits of capacity. Back in the late 18th, early 19th century, he wrote a lot about that. But it's certainly ideas that have been continued on from that time. In 1972, the Club of Rome commissioned a report on the limits to growth. There's been updates on that. And there's a whole group of people who are often called neo-Malthusians or Malthusians, who have these sorts of, carry on these sorts of theories. There are certainly critiques about it because a lot of the critics of these kind of beliefs say that many of the predictions didn't come true, and part of why they didn't come true is because the proponents like Malthus and others didn't take into account technological change or other changes that were beyond their prediction. And so therefore, why should we, think about or consider their theories? So what are the factors contributing to global overshoot? It's kind of an umbrella term, really. The big ones are human population levels, human development, resource depletion around water, oil, arable land and food production, and minerals, and of course anthropogenic global warming and climate change, and species extinction and habitat die-off. So I'm just going to go quickly through each of those points just briefly before I hand over to Tyson, who's got slightly more positive spin on things, you'll be relieved to know. In 1825, there were 1 billion people on the planet. Between then and this year, we've seen a 600% increase to over 7 billion people, or just on 7 billion. Don't know if you remember earlier in the year, there was the statistically seven billionth person was born in India. She's a girl called Nadra, I think. And that's her claim to fame for the rest of her life. So that's a 600% increase, as I said, from in less than 100 years, about 85 years. And the predictions are, you know, of that 7 billion, well, there are some estimates that that is actually more than the number of people, more people are alive today than have ever been alive at any history point in the, human history, which is kind of stunning, really, when you think about it. The Royal Society, in a British peak scientific body, in their report last year, People on the Planet, talked about by 2050, about they're expecting just over 9 billion people, which again is an increase of nearly a third on the population levels we have today. And over 85% of those people by that time are expected to live in less developed countries. But most of them are expected to live in cities, so that as at about 6 years ago, about nearly 50% of people on the earth lived in urban environments. By 2050, that's expected to be 70%. And that indicates massive changes for migration, land use, and a whole range of other things. There's a group known as the Global Footprint Network, which is a group of scientists and others who have got together and trying to develop ways to think about how humanity uses resources and uses the natural environment. Their position really is that up until the late 80s, everything that humanity produced, the planet could provide. So we were basically under that one planet level. Since the 80s, you can see there's been an increase, and at this point, we are now using over 1.5 Earth's worth of resources, water, and a whole range of other things. And it, on a business as usual scenario, which is the red line going upwards to the right, they're expecting by 2050 that we'll be using nearly 3 Earth's worth of resources. Clearly that's not sustainable. Another way of thinking about that, the Club of Rome suggested that if you think of the way we use the Earth and everything that it provides us as an annual budget, on August the 22nd this year, we started going into overdraft in terms of what we use. Another big aspect of global overshoot is resource depletion. And one of the biggest ones is drinkable water, basically. The US Geological Society estimates that we've got about 11 trillion cubic metres of fresh water available for human use. And that equates to about 1,700 cubic metres per person. Now, that's just a mean or average figure. There'll be some areas that are in water stress where they have access to far less than that, and some areas where they have access to a lot more just because of the pattern of rainfall and where the water is. Interestingly, the water stress index says that anything less than 1,700 cubic metres in a region indicates water stress. So we're kind of at a point where, for many people, they're heavily into a water stress situation. And water is, of course, fundamental to human life. As we know, groundwater contamination occurs because of industry, agriculture, and residential use and runoff. And that decreases the amount of potable water that's available at any one time. And the other thing that's going to have an impact on access to water is changes in rainfall due to climate change, leading to greater and greater reliance on aquifers and groundwater supplies. It was really interesting just doing some reading for this. The US Geological Society suggests that in the US, 40% of rivers and lakes are considered too polluted to support normal activities. In China, 80% of the rivers are so polluted that fish cannot survive in them. And in Japan, 30% of groundwater has been contaminated by industrial pollution. How are you going? You depressed yet? another aspect of resource depletion is the other vital fluid that we rely on in our society and globally is oil. Recently, the International Energy Agency, which is the UN peak body, which reviews the state of the world's energy and demands, reported that in its outlook that we would need, just to maintain our current supplies, because existing oil fields are depleting at such a rate, that we would actually need to find two times the current Middle East OPEC oil production just to maintain our current supply, when you consider that the Middle East is and has been for quite some time the largest producer of oil in the world. This is something that is of grave concern. It probably explains some of the geopolitical jockeying that you see now with the melting of the Arctic ice cap. A number of the countries in that region are becoming more aggressive in their territorial sort of claims in that area because of the potential oil and gas reserves in that area. And it also explains more locally some of the intense focus on the Kimberley. You'll probably be aware more recently in the news that it's a huge focus for industrialisation because of the availability of natural gas in that area. Oil currently represents the largest share of our energy sources in the world at 35%. And it's estimated that we will, because of our dependence on fossil fuels, spend an extra $8 trillion over the next 25 years to prolong the use of it. And that means that we are sort of going more for less conventional sources of oil, because the readily available oil has largely been found and exploited, extracted. So we're looking at things like shale oils and fracking to try and bring to the surface, and that's more expensive. It's worse in terms of carbon dioxide emissions, and it's not sustainable again. And the other point is that the International Energy Agency makes very clear is that we need to reduce CO2 equivalent emissions resulting from fossil fuel burning. If you wonder what that E is, it just stands for equivalent. Carbon dioxide is obviously the most significant so-called greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, but there are many others, including methane and others. The critiques around this sort of idea about peak oil are around this kind of criticism that humanity will just find another energy source, that we will make that transition, that it will be made readily available, and that potentially more oil and fossil fuel sources will be discovered. I think there was one critic of a contemporary critic of this kind of neo-Malthusian viewpoint, who's a guy called Julian Simon, has been quoted as saying that the supply of energy is infinite and oil will be infinite, and the second law of thermodynamics does not apply to human beings. So there are some critiques of the critiques as well, if you think that way. probably less obvious or less discussed anyway are things like peat minerals and arable land availability. In the 60s or in, I suppose, the 50s leading up to the 1960s, global crop production trebled, and that was a combination of a number of factors to do with increased mechanisation, the greater availability of fossil fuels to support that, better transport, and things like availability of phosphate to replenish what was taken from the earth in terms of growing the crops and harvesting them. Phosphate is probably one of the key ones, but like oil, they're non-renewable and they're subject to peak extraction as well. Phosphate, for example, which has underpinned fertilisation of crops and supporting the levels that we've achieved, has been reported as having a roughly a 30-year supply left that's viable or accessible. And there's no replacement for that that particular chemical that's yet been identified. So once we run out, then what do we do? The misuse and overuse of arable land, contamination through industrial development and a whole range of other issues like desertification and climate change mean that the availability of arable land is also declining as well. So we've got a kind of perfect storm in a way. There'll be increasing demand for food, less arable land, and potentially less resources to actually produce that. And that's, a huge challenge that's coming up. Species extinction. This is one that's, a little controversial in the fact that a lot of people believe that we're in the sixth mass extinction event at the moment. The five previous ones having occurred over geological history. A lot of people argue it's a natural process, which it is. But certainly, as you can see, the major threats currently to biodiversity generally are largely human influenced habitat destruction, overexploitation, pollution, alien species invasion, supported by humans often, and global climate change. It's estimated that of the total number of species that have ever lived on the Earth, only between 2% and 4% are alive today. And that of those, the this human-influenced mass extinction will look at the kind of loss of species that we're seeing today is estimated at being somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times the rate that you would expect to see as normal background extinction. And talking about controversy, this must be one of the big ones. AGW and climate change. Basically, the facts are that direct observations of the Earth's the global temperature show that there's been an increase of 0.8 degrees C since the early 20th century. Approximately two-thirds of that 0.8 degree warming, or over 0.5 of that degrees of that warming, has occurred since 1980. So we're talking in the span of decades. In the last slide, one of the major extinction events that I mentioned before occurred at the juncture of the Paleocene and the Eocene. And a lot of people believe that that was driven by huge shifts in climate, overwhelming the capability of most species to adapt. Now that temperature change appears to have occurred over thousands of years, and even that, in the opinion of most paleontologists and scientists, was very rapid. We're actually talking about significant warming within a much shorter time frame. And the overwhelming majority of scientists working in the area of climate, as you know, as well as the majority of peak scientific bodies around the world, agree that this warming is due to CO2 released by the burning of fossil fuels. There's a number of scenarios that scientists give in terms of the rate of future emissions, but on a business as usual trajectory, we're likely to see between 1.1 and 6.4 further degrees of warming over the rest of the 21st century. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, people say, you know, this 2 degrees is the magic marker that we should not be aiming to exceed. It's a little confusing when you think, oh, well, 2 degrees, I mean, it's what, 25, 27 today? Sure, it'd be just 29 degrees. That's unfortunately not how it works. It's not linear. Like all of these systems, climate is very complex. And here's a slide that kind of gives some idea of that. Basically, you've got incoming solar radiation coming through, being reflected by clouds, some of it, and by the surface, some absorbed by the surface, which then gets radiated back. Some then is absorbed by the atmosphere, and some of it leaves the Earth system. Where the big issue is coming in seems to be that by pumping more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, these gases, the molecular structure is transparent to the wavelength of solar radiation coming in, but unfortunately it is opaque to the reflected radiation going back out. So that's why people are pointing the finger at carbon dioxide as being the culprit to explain the majority of the warming that we've seen. Some of the impacts of even just a 2 degree rise will be significant sea level rise. Some people predict that significant parts of the coastal areas of many countries will be under sea level by the end of the century if nothing is done. With the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the ocean is seen as a heat sink and a sink for CO2. Unfortunately, while that helps stabilise some of the climate warming, it means that the chemical composition of the ocean is affected and it becomes more acid, which then has the knock-on effect of reducing the capacity of many species in the ocean to build their shells, which are made from calcium carbonate in a lot of instances. The other big thing that will happen is expected change in weather patterns and rainfall. Areas that are dry now are expected to become even drier. Areas that are wet now are expected to become even wetter. And that there will be increased, because of that, increased desertification and land loss. As we saw before, increased species extinction and habitat loss, and increased frequency and severity of extreme weather events, whether that be bushfires, flooding, cyclones and hurricanes, extreme rainfall. A lot of people think that even though we're in this part of Australia going to see a further drying of the climate, which we have all seen over the past few years, that when we do get rainfall, it will be much more intense and in a much shorter time frame, which increases the risk of flooding. And of course, the other thing that is expected to happen is the increase in the range of tropical and other diseases. As the environment warms, then the organisms that transmit or create those diseases move south as well, or north. So why are Tyson and I talking about this stuff? Well, basically, I've been following this issue, and I'm talking from my own perspective here. I've been following this issue for quite some time. The issues really have prompted as you would expect, levels of concern and fear in some instances, a lot of anger and a refusal to think about it at different points. But with that has come a kind of slow awakening of a desire to really make a difference in trying to reduce the potential negative outcomes. From my point of view, despite the fact that this term has been misused quite often, it is a moral issue. It's certainly a moral challenge. More than that, it's a scientific, engineering, geopolitical and economic challenge. And with challenges also come opportunities. So I think that's something that's been really important to me in thinking about this as a spiritual issue as well. The opportunity that we have to act in a way that God wants us to act in this and in other areas. I might hand over to you, Tyson, now. Thank you for listening, and hopefully this will make you feel a little better.
I'm optimistic because I believe we have the capacity at moments of great challenge to set aside the causes of distraction and rise to the challenge that history is presenting to us. Sometimes I hear people respond to the disturbing facts of the climate crisis by saying, oh, this is so terrible. What a burden we have. I would like to ask you to reframe that. How many generations in all of human history have had the opportunity to rise to a challenge that is worthy of our best efforts? That has a challenge that can pull from us more than we knew we could do. I think we ought to approach this challenge with a sense of profound joy and gratitude that we are the generation about which 1,000 years from now, Philharmonic orchestras and poets and singers will celebrate by saying they were the ones that founded within themselves to solve this crisis and lay the basis for a bright and optimistic human future. Let's do that. Thank you very much.
All right, that clip I find really inspirational. Basically, what we've heard today was the sort of thing that I found I had every week when I was studying sustainability. I'd come back and sit with Claire at lunchtimes and go, oh, we're all stuffed. There is no hope. And it's taken me a while to actually get through that and to get to a sense of actually there is stuff that we can do and we need to do. Some of the, well, people are changing, basically. So we've got we're seeing huge changes in the way that people are doing things, like we've seen peak private transport of cars. So people are driving less and using public transport more throughout the Western world. So the passenger car miles kind of thing is reducing. We're also seeing... peak population fertility has passed. So what we're seeing is the numbers of children born per woman on average around the planet. And our population is increasing, but it's now starting to increase slower than it has in the past. Okay. So population is one of those sort of things that has an 80-year lag because people live that long. So it takes us a while to see the population starting to level off and that type of thing. But it's one of those things that it's an issue that people are sort of raised and sort of shake their hands about and get all worked up about. But I think it's an issue that we are addressing. So I don't think that's a problem. Incidentally, so they're talking about the replacement rate. So that's accounting for, so you've got one child for mum, one for dad, and one for those that die before they get a chance to have more kids. So there's that 2.33 replacement rate. I'm anticipating that we're going to hit that pretty soon. I read a stat that said something like in the last 30 years we've gone from about 20 countries around the world that were at or below replacement rate. And that's gone to 70 countries around the world that are below replacement rate at the moment. So countries like Brazil, most of the Western world is below replacement rate. So we've got shrinking populations. It's not an issue. We have global movements that are starting to happen and that we're seeing, and things are changing. I'm really glad that Fleur read that book about St. Francis because it was... Oh, hang on. Oh, wrong slide. Yeah. Sorry. So basically countries are already taking action. The USA is the only country left that hasn't signed Kyoto Protocol. They're kind of a pariah now. The hole in the ozone layer is shrinking because we took action. And it was an issue that came up. The world's governments got together and they made a decision in about 6 months and it was done. So we have the capacity to organise politically and do things. That stat, the 16% of global land is now national parks, I came across, and I was like, that's crazy, you know? Like, what we see and hear in the news and expect is like everything's being cleared and we're losing all this stuff. And actually, we're taking significant action quite rapidly to protect more and more parts of the world that aren't already clear-felled. In terms of our pollution and all that type of thing, we're changing. The world is economically shifting towards thinking about carbon emissions in a different way. And I take hope in that because I can see it's a way that we are actually addressing some of the main issues. I'll go to that one next. One of the things that I wanted us to start thinking about, particularly for the next talk, is this area called deep ecology. Deep ecology is where we value things not just because of what they can give to us, but for their own right. And this is an idea that I got from Michael Wood a few years ago, and I haven't really done anything with it, but it's something I'd like to explore more. We've assigned everything a value to us. So, what's that tree out there worth? Well, it's worth keeping because it keeps me alive, because it gives me oxygen, not because it's a tree that God created. So deep ecology is shifting, and I think from a Christian perspective, we can see value in things because God created them. Deep ecology is something that's going around the world, and it's bringing in people of all sorts of different faiths as well. So it's it's not just a Christian thing, and it's what I think the Christian church has kind of gotten onto it sort of later than a lot of the others. But you can see there that the Eastern Orthodox Patriarch is really into this stuff, and so that's kind of leading that part of the church. The Catholic Church has put out statements that they say that they support this type of thinking, and it feels like some of us Western Protestants seem to be way behind. The Bible reading today from Genesis is being used as the rationale for a lot of what we've done to the planet in terms of subduing and conquering and using it for our own ends. And I would like the Western Church to give that up in the same way we've given up stoning of adulterers and disobedient children, because in the way that we've said that those biblical verses and commands maybe aren't applicable anymore, maybe this command to go and subdue the earth is maybe not so good either. But I would also like to use a different mindset to read that, because I've read it as a linear command, go out and do this, tick, it's done, rather than a sense of how the Jewish people originally who wrote this, how did they interpret it? Okay, what gives me hope is people. And when I see people switched on and using their brains and using the creativity that we've been given, it inspires me. This is something that when I was working in doing home energy assessments, I'd visit people's houses and see what they were doing, and it was one of those things, you know, you'd come across someone's little, you know, home invention to shade that part of the house or do this or whatever it was, and it was fantastic because it was really inspiring to see people using their creativity and inventiveness and resourcefulness to actually overcome a problem that they saw. And it wasn't universal, but you know, people were pretty clever. I think we're also a lot more resilient than we think. The counter argument to that is that we are a lot more selfish than we think, and a lot more protective of our own patch than we think. I would say also that the problem is not a technological problem, it's a political problem, in the sense that it's about us getting together and deciding this is what we want to do. I think the rate at which we have technological development means that we have the capacity to invent and come up with ideas and solutions to what are essentially physics problems. Having said that, technology is not the answer. Technology is the way we get there, but the answer is not about trying to invent the magic bullet and off we go. It's actually about people. And the thing that most inspires me, I think, is just how amazing I find nature to be. I'm sort of looking at Paul because over the last few weeks we've had bottle brush and paper bark and everything just going absolutely mental all in our streets. And you could probably sit under one of those trees and spend 10 years just counting how many little honky nuts or little things come off each one. But the thought really came to me when I was sitting under an oak tree about 3 years ago. It's massive. And it was had acorns all over it, and I thought, how many millions of acorns are on this oak tree? You know? And I thought, nature doesn't do things like I do it. You know, you plant 3 seeds in the veggie patch and you water them carefully and you protect them and all the rest. Nature goes, here's 3 million seeds. Off we go. So that, to me, is something that I find it quite overwhelming, actually. So I think that if we give nature a chance, it can do its thing. And I mean, everyone makes a difference. It's been part of my personal mantra is the old starfish analogy. You know, a person walking along the beach and throwing starfish back into the sea. And it didn't matter to, you know, what difference is making, it mattered to that one. I put that together with maybe a romantic kind of interpretation of the power of one book and movie, and the sense that one person actually does and can make a difference. And if it's that one person that you, or that one starfish that you throw back that makes a difference, then it's awesome. And off we go. So, to finish, I would like to play a video if I can get it going quickly enough. And then I'll hand back to Claire.